This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Knowing what your peers earn. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
If you're interested in learning how much money your colleagues are making and spending, new services can help.
Inside the social media world of professional athletes, like how they use LinkedIn.
If you had 10 seconds to guess how much you spend each month on digital services and subscriptions, chances are you'd be way off.
And the best big cities in which to live and work.
Well, these big cities are less than 3% of the U.S. just in terms of land mass, but they actually contain around 80% of the total U.S. population. So we wanted to see which of these big cities were the best places to call home. And we looked at affordability, overall economic factors, education, health, and safety.
Jill Gonzalez at Wallet Hub on which cities made the cut. She's here in about 10 minutes. President Trump is steering U.S. economic policy in a radically new direction, from trying to revive steelmakers with tariffs to vetoing Chinese technology investments. He's using the federal government to direct which industries prosper and which don't. So says Wall Street Journal chief economics commentator Greg Ip. Greg, explain.
I think if you look at all of the things that President Trump is doing on steel, on coal, on aluminum, on confronting China, it adds up to a pattern of behavior that suggests that he wants the federal government to play a much more interventionist and muscular role in the economy in terms of deciding what industries do what, you know, which investors and which companies and workers win and which ones don't. And in the past, other countries have done this. It's called what economists call industrial policy. The United States has tended not to do it because there is a great suspicion that it's just not very good at picking winners. But Trump seems to be taking the U.S. in a different direction.
So in this case, does the administration deliberately pick winners and losers, or that's the nature of policy approach?
It's a good point. They would never say themselves that they're picking winners and losers, but that's really what it amounts to. So let's look at the steel and aluminum tariffs, for example. The administration argues that we need a stronger domestic industry for national security purposes. This is not an argument that anybody who follows national security closely actually believes. His own defense secretary says that imports do not threaten the Defense Department's ability to source its own needs for steel and aluminum. But if you look a little more closely, what Trump says is that you need to have a big steel and aluminum industry to be a normal country. You don't have a strong country needs a steel industry. That is a statement of industrial policy. It essentially associates one particular sector, steel, with special qualities. And it's a way of saying that I don't care if the private market in its own collective aggregate private wisdom believes that we don't need more steel production here. I think we do, and I'm willing to intervene to make that happen, in this case by imposing very high tariffs on every other country that sells steel to the United States.
Well, we're speaking with the Wall Street Journal's chief economic commentator, Greg Ip, and he's written a piece entitled President's Emerging Economic Policy, Picking Winners and Losers. President Obama was accused of picking winners and losers, wasn't he, when there was that bailout following or during the financial crisis?
Sure, yes. Obama was actually criticized for helping bail out large banks and car manufacturers. I suppose you could argue that those were extenuating circumstances. Private markets had completely shut down because we were in this panic-driven mode, and that the kind of opportunistic capital that often arrives to take advantage of assets that are extremely cheap was just not there. So the federal government provided that opportunistic capital, and you could say that they were in some sense vindicated because they were able to exit those positions several years later and, with one or two exceptions, make a profit.
Well, we're speaking with the Wall Street Journal's chief economic commentator, Greg Ip, and he's written a piece entitled President's Emerging Economic Policy, Picking Winners and Losers. Do you take a stab at all at identifying who might be the biggest loser in all of this, in these tariffs?
Well, sure. So, for example, the tariffs on steel and aluminum, obviously, if you make steel and aluminum, if you're a steel and aluminum worker, you're a winner. If you consume steel and aluminum, you're a loser. General Motors and Ford have said that they expect to incur hundreds of millions of dollars of additional costs because of the higher price of steel and aluminum needed to make their vehicles. That can't be good for their workers. It can't be good for their decisions to source more production in the United States. Thousands of companies have asked for exemptions from these tariffs because they say the steel and aluminum they need isn't made in the United States. A lot of them will not get those exemptions. They're going to have to decide whether to raise costs and lose sales or move production to other countries. You know, we've seen this in the past. I'll give you one example. The United States protects its sugar industry. 20 years ago, it made it impossible for the candy industry in the United States to thrive. So some candy factories moved to Canada and other countries. So you have to accept the fact that if you are going to protect one industry from foreign competition, then you're going to impose costs on all the other industries that rely on that foreign competition to keep their own costs low. You may end up creating more losers than you do winners.
So you referenced in the story and mentioned it earlier about national security concerns being floated here as a reason for the tariffs. But what? How does China factor into all this?
So China is an interesting case because the Trump administration, in keeping with its policy, is saying, all right, these companies may not buy U.S. technology companies. Broadcom may not buy Qualcomm because we think that's endangering Qualcomm's innovative capacity. They've asked for and they're about to receive from Congress much broader powers to vet foreign investment, especially Chinese and Russian investment in U.S. high-tech companies. They don't even have to prove that there's a direct national security connection. They just have to say that these technologies, for example, artificial intelligence and big data, they're really vital to the U.S. technological edge, and we just don't think foreigners should be allowed to own them. And here there's a bit more of an argument that Trump's on the right track than with respect to the steel situation.
Thanks, Greg. It's Wall Street Journal chief economics commentator Greg Ipp. It is 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us, with July and August ranking among the most popular months to move, and about 80% of the U.S. population living in urban areas. The personal finance website WalletHub has released its report on the best big cities to live in. We're joined now by WalletHub analyst Jill Gonzalez. Jill, what did you look at?
Well, these big cities are less than 3% of the U.S. just in terms of land mass, but they actually contain around 80% of the total U.S. population. So we wanted to see which of these big cities were the best places to call home, and we looked at affordability, its overall economic factors, education, health, and safety.
And what was the top five, for example?
Number five was San Diego. Then moving up north in California was San Francisco. Then Austin, Texas. Number two was Virginia Beach in Virginia. And number one was Seattle.
When I think of like affordability, San Francisco does not come to mind in your as number four on the list here.
Yeah, San Francisco ranked lower when it comes to affordability, but when it comes to its economy, education, health systems, quality of life, safety, all of those factors were high enough to push it up to the top five.
Honolulu, too, I think. Wow, expensive. How'd that make the list?
Honolulu, expensive, definitely more expensive to travel to. Once you're there, not as expensive. You know, home prices are okay, but home taxes are some of the lowest in the country. So those are things that we looked at as well.
Did it surprise anybody that New York came in as the 10th best city to live in?
So New York ranked as the most expensive, but it also ranked number one when it comes to quality of life, things to do, et cetera. And also was one of the safest cities on the list here, particularly when it comes to its public transportation and its low violent crime rate.
Wow. What are some of the other ones that jumped out in the top 20?
Other ones that people might be surprised or maybe not to see in the top 20, Denver is in there at number 12. Vegas is number 13. Washington, D.C. is number 18.
I was surprised with some of these stats about Virginia Beach, Virginia. I know number two on the list, but like home ownership, share of residents living in poverty. Explain those numbers.
Virginia Beach has the highest home ownership rate. Almost 100% of the people there are owners. So not a lot of renters. When we're looking at places to live, that certainly bodes well. It also has the lowest percentage of its population living in poverty. So you don't see a lot of homelessness there, et cetera.
It's impressive. We're speaking with Jill Gonzalez, analyst at WalletHub.com, and they've put together a list of the best big cities to live in. What were some of the other stats that jumped out at you?
As far as some of the worst bigger cities to live in, some surprising, some certainly not. Indianapolis ranked down here, St. Louis, Baltimore, Cleveland, Memphis, and unfortunately still in the bottom here is Detroit.
Wow. What else do you think is worth a mention?
Some other cool stats that we were looking at, we looked at the highest income growth just over the past year. So income has been pretty stable for a few years now, but in places like Austin, Seattle, and San Francisco, actually grew at a rate of around 5% within the last year. Huge number.
That's overall like economic growth that you're talking about?
Or that's just income growth, so personal income growth.
Wow. And then how about cities maybe that have made a climb or a drop on the list? Any of that noted?
As far as cities in general, you know, Texas cities typically do very well. Austin came in number one in prior years, so this year it fell to number three. Virginia Beach, obviously, doing some big things in terms of its economy. Seattle, I think, just in terms of jobs, was hard to beat this year. Other places that have certainly made a climb include San Diego and San Jose in California. San Jose was number eight this year. And Minneapolis was up at number 11 this year, usually not even in the top 20.
How about that? Thanks, Jill. Jill Gonzalez, analyst at Wallet Hub. It's 20 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Hey, don't forget, we can connect on social media, by the way. You can friend us on Facebook. You can also follow the show on Twitter with the username at This Morning Show. You can follow me directly on Twitter as well with the username at Gordon Deal. Money remains an off-limits subject in many social circles, but technology is making it easy to compare yourself to others and not just on Facebook. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
We're speaking with MarketWatch personal finance reporter Maria LaMagna. Her piece is called, Are You Spending More Than Your Peers? These Companies Will Tell You. Maria, what's this about?
Yeah, so this kind of caught my eye. You know, I write a lot about different kinds of financial services companies, and I was noticing that several of them are now kind of getting at showing people how they compare with other people. So there's a company called Status Money, and it's basically formed on the idea that if you sign up, you tell them, you know, your bank account information, your credit score, all these different factors. They'll actually tell you how you stack up compared to other people, either in your age bracket or in your same area, and you can kind of just see how am I doing compared to other people that I might be sort of in the same demographics with.
You know, I had to read it three times. You're opening two sentences about this husband and wife in the suburbs of D.C. facing student loans of almost $300,000.
I know. It's a pretty stunning number. But yes, the wife in the couple is a physical therapist, and she ended up having to take on a lot of debt, you know, to actually get all the certifications that she needed. So, yes, they were facing really huge bills, and they were saying, you know, to this point about comparing yourself to other people, sometimes you have to really shut that off. You know, they never used an actual company or service that compares them to others, but even just socially or seeing other people's photos on Facebook and that kind of thing, you have to get a grip on that and really not pay attention to it if you have a really big financial goal like they had. You know, they were telling me on the phone they don't want to have children until they're debt-free, so it's really about focusing on your personal goal instead of where other people are compared to you.
So just this thing of new companies now that help you save and then compare you to others.
Yes. So what was interesting, I thought, is that previous research has actually shown that if people are shown, you know, that their peers are spending less than they are, they will appropriately reel in their own spending. So it's kind of based on that idea, and these companies are trying to add a little bit more transparency to this whole conversation about keeping up with the Joneses and that kind of thing. So Status Money is one of them, as we mentioned, and the company SoFi, which is known for refinancing student loans, they actually have a feature on there called Social Comparison, and you can see compared to other SoFi members where you stack up, and you know, in terms of do I have more debt or less, you know, and what is my income compared to other people, and you can kind of see, you know, how you're doing compared to others, and if you feel like, oh, wow, a lot of people are making more than I am, that can either inspire you to, you know, maybe think about a new job or maybe negotiate differently, but all of the companies were saying it's really about kind of inspiring people to get on others' level if they are a little bit behind, and it's also about just adding more transparency and letting people know, you know, this is what a lot of people are spending on their interest rates, and if yours is way more than that, maybe you need to reconsider.
We're speaking with MarketWatch's personal finance reporter Maria LaMagna. She's written a piece entitled, Curious How Much Your Peers Are Making and Spending? These companies will tell you. I think you said, too, there are apples-to-apples comparisons, too, right? So it kind of matches college grads versus college grads, things like that?
Yes, so you can actually see how you stack up compared to other alumni of, you know, the same university that you went to. So I've actually done it myself. It's kind of inspiring in a way, but it can also be, you know, kind of daunting. So I think you have to remind yourself, you know, everyone's on a different path and, you know, we all make different choices, so you don't necessarily have to feel like you have to make as much as other alumni of your same school. But yes, it definitely does feel like a closer to home when you can see who exactly you're being compared to.
Go back to that couple you opened the story with the $300,000 in student loans. They've stopped doing that, right? They don't want to know or compare to others. They're comfortable now mentally with their approach here.
Exactly. They've done well. You know, they're kind of buckling down and they've said, you know, we're not going to go to weddings we can't afford. For their own wedding, they kept it really small. You know, they're saying no to trips that they can't afford. So they really are trying to just stay focused on their goal. And, you know, when you're facing as much debt as they are, that's really important. And I think that they're making some good progress and they're blogging about it on the way. So they're, you know, doing as much as they can and trying to take on side jobs and really trying to attack the debt really aggressively.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with MarketWatch personal finance reporter Maria LaMagna. She opened that story with this fact from that family about their student loans. Here's the opening sentence. It says, Josh Hastings and his wife Lauren are facing student loans of almost $300,000. Those are the folks that wreck the curve, right? When you hear student debt of about 25 or 30 grand. Man, it's 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. We'd like to welcome a new sponsor to the show, Untuck It. You know, it's never a good look when you untuck a long, bulky dress shirt. Untuck It makes shirts specifically designed to be worn untucked. A casual shirt that's not too long and not too short. It's just right. And not only do they look good, they feel great. And if you're a woman, by the way, wishing you can have one of these, well, Untuck It now makes shirts for women, too. Log on to untuckit.com and check out all the new arrivals. Use the promo code GORDONDEAL for 20% off your entire purchase. You can also visit one of Untuck It's over 25 retail locations across the country. Untuckit.com, your solution to perfecting casual. Use the promo code GORDONDEAL for 20% savings. Again, untuckit.com and use the promo code GORDONDEAL for 20% savings. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka coming up this half hour. How you might be too much of a team player at work. Also, how pro athletes use LinkedIn. And you're spending more on your subscription services each month than you think. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. What should we expect to happen next now that President Trump has used Twitter to warn Iran about threatening the U.S.? There's no way to know for sure, but Mr. Trump himself has actually provided a helpful case study. It's a story by Uri Friedman, staff writer at The Atlantic. Uri set this up.
Yeah, well, I was struck when Donald Trump tweeted at Iran's president saying, you know, if you don't stop threatening the United States, you will suffer consequences unlike any people throughout history have suffered. I was struck by how much that was similar to what Donald Trump said almost a year ago in August to North Korea, saying, you know, North Korea best not threaten the United States or they will suffer fire and fury the likes of which the world has never seen. So almost identical language. And what was interesting in particular about that is I think a lot of people, you know, reading Donald Trump's Twitter feed might wonder, Donald Trump, in all caps, has threatened Iran with war. What does that mean? What happens next? And we actually have an interesting case study here where this happened a year ago, and we know, at least as of a year, how it's turned out in the case of North Korea.
Wow. All right. So what are the lessons here?
Well, I think one is that, you know, a lot of times people think about the American president as choosing his words very carefully and only saying what he means. I think one thing we've learned about Donald Trump is that he's actually perfectly okay with a lot of bluster that might not actually be backed up. And, you know, he doesn't necessarily feel compulsion to, you know, enforce his red lines when he draws them. And then secondly, there are a lot of dangers. And one of the dangers to keep top of mind is that when you engage in this bluff, these bluffs and this brinksmanship, you risk actually triggering a war, because the adversary doesn't know where the red lines are, and sometimes you might want to back up your threats. And also, you know, just when two sides are engaging in brinksmanship, it's not only about words. It can lead to actions. That's a lesson from history, and that's what we have to keep in mind, not just with North Korea, but also with Iran.
Yeah. In North Korea, at least since then, right, or since some of this rhetoric on social media or wherever, has seemed to have kept them fairly quiet. They're not at the front burner the way they were.
No. You know, I think one thing that there's a lot of criticism of Donald Trump's summit with Kim Jong-un in Singapore, saying, you know, nothing came out of it that was very tangible, and we haven't seen a lot of huge progress yet. But one thing it did really succeed with, I think, is that it did reduce tensions between these two countries that were really at the brink with each other because of North Korea's advances in its nuclear program. When we think about threats, the definition of a threat, if you ask national security officials, is capability and intent. North Korea still has all the capability of its nuclear program, but its intent is lessened because right now we're talking to each other. And so that is something that has succeeded with North Korea. Now, we have no indication so far that the Trump administration is prepared to, you know, engage in a summit with the Ayatollah in Tehran. But that is one possibility among many about how this could all turn out.
Mm. We're speaking with Uri Friedman, staff writer at The Atlantic, and he's written an interesting piece entitled Trump, Iran, and the Dangers of Presidential Bluffing. So this approach he has of being unpredictable, it's a deliberate tactic or unintentional and works sometimes? How do you see it?
Well, he himself has articulated this as a goal of his. He doesn't want people to know what he's thinking. He likes being unpredictable. I think it is deliberate to a certain extent. Part of it is dispositional. I mean, I think Donald Trump is not someone who has, with some exceptions, has extremely fixed principles. I think he is flexible, and he does kind of move around ideologically depending on what he thinks is in the best interest of his agenda. And so I think part of it is just the nature of Donald Trump in terms of his personality. But I think it is also a tactic that he has himself articulated, which is that, you know, you get a better deal if the other side doesn't really know where you're at.
Thanks, Uri. Uri Friedman, staff writer at The Atlantic. It's 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. With a sweeping workplace trend pushing collaboration, some people are finding they play a little too well with others, causing stress and overwork. When you hear the phrase bad team player, you might think of someone who refuses to collaborate, but you can also hurt your organization if you burn out trying to accommodate every coworker's request or attending more meetings than you can keep up with. Wall Street Journal columnist Sue Schellenberger says this can stem from a basic inability to draw boundaries or an ego-driven desire to look like an office MVP. Sue, set the scene.
Many, many workers are spending almost all of their time collaborating with other people, clients and colleagues, on email and meetings and conferences, on phone calls. And it's very easy to get sucked into interacting with others all the time to the point where you become overloaded and burned out. And this was a finding of a major study at Babson College, 8-year, 28 employer study on the topic that really goes in depth into how all this collaborating is affecting people's work lives.
Wow. So you got some folks who just say yes to everything?
Yes, it's a temptation. Sometimes if you're deep into a lot of complex, ambiguous projects, which happens a lot these days, and somebody comes along and says, can you help me with this task? It's something you know really well. It's tempting to just say yes because, A, it feels good to help other people. B, maybe your coworkers will see you as valuable and as an expert. These are the subtle things that can happen when you're really up to your neck in collaborative projects.
And what are the dangers here?
Well, the dangers in the study, the head researcher Robert Cross found that some people just slowly become so overwhelmed, kind of like the frog in the cook pot. They're taking on more and more until they really aren't able to function well anymore. One woman started having serious health problems, and they wind up either burning out on the job and not doing well or even quitting their jobs. In other cases, employees are able to adapt. They figure out, well, I'm going to have to let go of some things in order to do the rest of this stuff I've been assigned really well. They're the ones who learn how to delegate and hand tasks off. So there really is a demarcating line between those who survive and those who really become overwhelmed.
Wow. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal columnist Sue Schellenberger. Her piece is called "You Could Be Too Much of a Team Player." So how do you say no?
It's tricky. I think you really have to pull back and create planning time on your calendar. This was one of the imperatives that came out of this study. You have to focus on certain goals as if they were your North Star and make time as often as you need it to sit and think, okay, what are my top objectives here? And you may be working on multiple projects at once with multiple teams. This is a common situation in today's workplace. You need to identify the highest priority goals and delegate other things. So set aside planning time, set aside important things for things that are even more important, and if necessary, talk to your supervisors. You know, here are my priorities right now. Here's what I can handle and what I can't handle. So it really calls for a new kind of planning skill, really, and communicating skill to keep your to-do list manageable.
I thought it was interesting, too, like Microsoft has even stepped in to try to help you with some software, right?
Right. They've created a tool on their Outlook platform where you it will nudge you if you begin to plan too many meetings, if you're wall-to-wall with meetings, which can easily happen with people who are working on multiple teams at once. You get in so many meetings that you have no time to do your own work, and you wind up staying after work to do your real work, right? So, yes, Microsoft has drawn on this research by Robert Cross at Babson College and actually started creating some tools to help people manage their meeting time.
Jeez. On a somewhat related note, there was a point about not answering every email that comes your way, too, right?
That's right. Some people, another pitfall that you can fall into when you're collaborating on multiple projects is you want a sense of closure, which isn't always something you get in the complicated work we do today. So you might decide, I'm going to empty my email box every evening, and I'm going to answer every email that's in there, and that'll give me a rewarding sense of closure. That can be hazardous, too, because, first of all, you probably don't have to answer all those emails, especially if the answers you send are poorly thought out or hasty. That just creates confusion or problems for the people who receive them, and you wind up making more work, which in this study is a gauge of effectiveness. Like, can you get the most done while wasting the least amount of your colleagues' time?
Thanks, Sue. Wall Street Journal columnist Sue Schellenbarger. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and advanced manufacturing. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit michiganbusiness.org. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The best place to start or grow your business is at michiganbusiness.org. Contact them today. When you think of your favorite athletes, you probably think of them as just that, athletes. But now these sports stars are being recognized for their achievements outside their game and inside business. This weekend's Max Chadwick with more on one social media app that is helping these players in their business ventures.
Professional athletes, but also business tycoons. We're speaking with Leo Sepkowitz. He's a writer for Bleacher Report who's written a piece called Now This Is What I Do Inside the World of Athletes LinkedIn Pages. Leo, what'd you find?
Well, I found that a lot of athletes are using LinkedIn, which came as a big surprise to me initially. It doesn't seem like a platform that would necessarily lend itself to athletes who have large networks and established careers already and are already in the public eye. And yet, the more I looked, the more athletes I found on there. You have Barry Bonds, Shaquille O'Neal, Andre Iguodala, Steph Curry, and then all the way down to European players who most people have never heard of. And it was interesting to hear the different ways that it's helping out different types of players.
Leo, I guess the question we're all wondering is why these athletes, many of whom make tens of millions of dollars, like you said, why do they even want to use LinkedIn in the first place?
Yeah, that was my question initially, too. And the more I spoke to players and the more I thought about it, the more it started to make sense. Basically, we're in an era where players are becoming more than just players. And some guys are doing that during their careers. And some are establishing second careers when their playing days are over. But either way, everybody in sports is sort of getting into something else after basketball or baseball or whatever it may be. A lot of the times that's investing in tech or starting up a company. And just being an entrepreneur in general. And a lot of players see LinkedIn as a way to establish themselves as businessmen and businesswomen while they're still athletes. It's a way to connect with people outside the scope, as one player told me.
We're speaking with Leo Sefcovitz. He's a writer for Bleacher Report who's written a story called Now This Is What I Do, Inside the World of Athletes' LinkedIn Pages. Leo, who are some of the other high-profile athletes making the most of LinkedIn?
The player I really had a great time speaking to was Baron Davis, who I loved watching when he was on the Warriors. He retired a few years ago after a long career, and he talked about not really being sure what to do. And this came up a lot, actually. Brickshaw Ferguson, who was a tackle for the Jets, I was a big Jets fan growing up, spoke about it too, not being sure what to do after retirement. And so Davis recalled sitting on his couch and thinking, I have resources and I have interests, but I don't really know what to do. And all of a sudden he thought, all right, I guess I'll look at LinkedIn. And the more he started looking at it, the more he realized a lot of players like him, people like him were on there looking for a way to use their resources and connect.
How about that? So go connect with pro athletes, right? It's our intern, Max Chadwick, with Leo Sefcovitz of Bleacher Report. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. Streaming music, TV, movies, and video games on demand, and signing up for subscription boxes that deliver things like groceries is siphoning away more money than many people realize. A new survey by Waterstone Management Group finds 84% of Americans grossly underestimate their monthly tech spending. As Moneyish.com says, convenience is costly. Americans were asked to spend 10 seconds thinking generally about what they spend on recurring monthly expenses associated with digital services, devices, and subscription boxes. People guessed they spent about $80 a month on average, but when they were prompted to consider some specific examples of services like Netflix, Spotify, iCloud, Fitbit, they raised their monthly estimate to $111, a 40% increase. Then when subjects were shown an exhaustive list of subscription services and categories like Wi-Fi and cell service, they realized they were actually dropping $237 a month, a 197% increase from their first guess. For Jennifer Koshenka and Max Chadwick, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news! There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.